what's up, guys? Welcome to the Deconstruction Zone podcast. This is Danny Liebarger, the host. So glad you're here with us. And we have a special treat, kind of a unique episode. We're going to be listening to a talk that pastor, author, and speaker Colby Martin gave at our church, The Well, just this past weekend. You may know Colby. He is famous for his two books that he has written on Clobber, which looks at the six Clobber passages primarily used to condemn LGBTQ plus people and re-examines those. And his most recent book, The Shift, which explores the movement from conservative Christianity to more progressive Christianity. He calls it somewhat of a survival guide. So if you haven't read either of those, I would invite you to do so. But for this episode, we're just going to play the conversation that we had with Colby. And it's going to be a fun one. And so if you missed it, this is a great chance to tune in. Or maybe you want to share it and listen. You can do that as well. But friends, it's going to be a fun conversation with Colby. I invite you now to dive in and listen.
Good evening, friends. We are so glad you are here for what is going to be a, I think, really, really wonderful night. A couple of like logistics and housekeeping things. First being, if I haven't had a chance to meet you yet, my name is Danny. I am the pastor here at The Well, and we're just excited and glad that you're here. Maybe you'll never come back and join us for worship again. That's totally fine for us because we're just excited to have a conversation with you guys about topics we think really, really matter. And we want to be able to have that with people across our region. Part of our mission and vision is to spark a movement of inclusion across our region where preaching inclusion is no longer radical. And we think the ability to gather folks like this from different churches, from different communities to come together is one of the ways that we start that. And so it actually warms my heart to see folks from different communities, different churches coming to be a part of this. And so I think it's going to be a really, really fun night. And I am not the main speaker. Our friend Colby is. And so, yeah, let's give him a round of applause. So I think Colby will have some stuff to say about himself, but if you haven't had a chance to meet him, or maybe you've never heard of him before, he is someone that comes with a wealth of pastoral experience. He said about 20 years in pastoral ministry and spent time primarily kind of in more evangelical spaces. And I think like many of us here, spent time wrestling with the conversation that came face to face with us about inclusion. And not just like LGBTQ plus inclusion, that's what's been something for many of us. Like, I think just inclusion at the highest level, right? Like, what does it actually mean to be people that are following this way of Jesus? And we feel like it's a way that's inclusive and we hear this conversation for all of us. And I think Colby's been wrestling with that for a while now and has written two great books that have been resources for, I think, many of our congregation, both on Clobber and The Shift. Books that you'll have a little bit of time to talk about. And if you don't have one of them, we have them in the back. We would love you to grab some before you get here. Again, they have been just amazing resources for folks within our community. And so I'm just speaking from the knowledge of people I know. It's been very, very meaningful. And if you haven't read either of them, or maybe you've just read one and the other, like I would really challenge you, pick it up and use it as a way not just to inform yourself about a larger conversation, but maybe it's a really great way to have a conversation with someone else in your life that is interested in this conversation but doesn't know how to start. But with that in mind, again, I am not the keynote. I am just the MC. And so I'm going to say just a quick prayer for us as we go into this, because I do know we come in with different things. And some of us come in really excited about this. Some of us come in very nervous about this conversation. And we want to create space for everyone. And the way best I know how to create that space is going together in prayer. So would you guys pray with me? God, I thank you so much for this opportunity just to dive into big and important topics with your people. And so I just ask your Holy Spirit and your blessing be over this time, over Colby and the words he shares for us. And I just ask that you would nudge us all towards what it means to embrace your great commandment, to love you with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and just as, if not more importantly, to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so I just hope you will nudge us and challenge us in that truth here today. Pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Good evening. Count of seven. Everybody tell me how you doing tonight. One, two, three. Some of you are like, is he really going to go to seven? Four, five. Oh, no, premature. I just needed time to get this mic in place. Six, seven. That's a lot of great. One mediocres. Thank you for your honesty. Thank you. The world needs more mediocrity. I mean, more honesty. Thank you. To answer your question, how am I doing? Thanks for asking. I'm wonderful. It is really, really good to be here with you. Shortly before getting here this evening, a quick show of hands, just so that I know the room a little bit, and so that I'll know when I repeat myself how embarrassed to be. Raise your hand if you were here this morning. Okay, so about half the room was here this morning, about half the room this is new for. Great. So before I came here tonight, I was at Starbucks refueling for the evening and going over my notes, and I did posted a story on Instagram thanks to some photos from Sadie this morning. Thank you, Sadie. And in the post, I said, people will often ask me, because I travel a lot and I do this kind of work. I'll get into more of that in a minute here, but I travel and visit churches like this a lot. But when I say that, that's not because there's a lot of churches like this to visit. There's actually not. You're unique. You're rare. At the risk of inflating your heads, you're special here. this is a special place here. And actually, I don't even know if the whole room is a part of the well or if some of you are visitors or what. Irregardless, which my college professor says, I know it's not a word, but it's fun to say. So irregardless of whether or not this is your church home, if it is, the well, like, it's a special place. There's not a lot of these in our country right now. But I'm hopeful. When people ask me, as they do, they say, are you hopeful for the church? Like, are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic for the church? Mornings like this morning fill me with great optimism and hope. Because I've been doing this work for about 10, 11 years now. And I'll just say this, there's far more churches like this now 10 years ago than there was 10 years ago. And that is a sign for me of great hope, that this effort to broaden the arms of Christianity from its narrowification, I'm just going to make up words all night long, from the narrowification of the way that the worst parts of religion, I'm not anti-religion, by the way. I think religion is just a tool. Like any other tool, can be used for good or evil, but it has this propensity to elucidate the worst parts of a movement like Christianity. And religion has kind of strangled the best parts of this movement that started with this rabbi 2,000 years ago that had these ideas based on his experience with the divine, that maybe mercy is better than sacrifice, that maybe love is better than hate, that maybe forgiveness is better than revenge. And so churches like this renew my hope that the movement to broaden the arms of Christianity and to release it from the shackles of how it's been held back by this myopic, fear-filled religious perspective, y'all give me hope is my point. Long, get to the point, Colby. Y'all give me hope. And so I'm really glad to be here with you and tonight. So what are we doing tonight? Great question. Thank you for asking. What I want to do is I'm gonna talk and say some things for about 50 minutes, and if I sense you getting bored, I will understand what you're saying, and I will adjust accordingly. But I will attempt to hold your attention for somewhere around 50 minutes, and if not, Jared's just gonna kick bottles over just to wake everybody up, and then we're gonna pivot to a bit of a Q&R time. I say Q&R because I don't always have answers, but I always have responses. I will respond to your questions, and Danny will come back up and help facilitate that. So if at any point throughout the night something gets stirred in you or a question comes to mind and you would like to ask it, just jot it down, write it down, tell your neighbor so that you don't forget, and then we can talk about it in about an hour from now, okay? And then we'll be done here in about 90, 100 minutes from now. And I think... the restrooms are, if anybody needs, you can get up and go, and they're in the hallway there, and anytime you need to get up, feel free. And there's also coffee in the back if you want. I want to talk to you a bit about me. I want to talk to you a bit about God, and then I want to talk a bit about you. Me, God, and you. I was born and raised into a family of Baptists. I am a recovering Baptist.
Thank you. Yes, I could tell, right? For just the way your spirit were like, yes, I see you. The recovering Baptist in me sees the recovering Baptist in you. So I was born into a family that was your typical conservative Baptist home. We were in church multiple times a week for choir practice, youth group, church service. My dad comes from a long line of Baptists and Mennonites. My mom was a first-generation Christian when she met my dad. And that was my experience for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years. Can't really remember because childhood trauma kicked in about that time from parents' divorce. So a lot of childhood I don't really remember. Sort of a drawn-out separation of parental units that ultimately ended in divorce. And so my dad moved out, and me and my two brothers stayed with my mom. We stayed at the Baptist church for a while, but as I recall, or as my mom tells the story, you know, back in that time, I'm sure they've come a long way since, but back then the Baptists didn't know what to do with divorced families, right? And so being a single mom with three young boys, I think, was just weird for her, and not having her husband, my dad, in the picture anymore, just whatever. She eventually sort of took us out of that church, and we found ourselves in a more generic evangelical church, and I grew, this was in Oregon, Albany, Oregon. And I'm going to youth group, and I'm just doing my thing, because that's what we do. And I'm getting ready to go into my senior year of high school. And in the summer leading into the senior year of my high school, I go on a trip with my youth pastor and some kids from our youth group from Oregon down to Huntington Beach, Southern California, for a week-long conference, I think maybe it was called, called SEMP, S-E-M-P. It's an acronym, Students Equipped to Minister to Peers. And the whole point of the week was to train high school students on the art of apologetics. And apologetics is a big fancy way that means, how do I prove that I'm right and you're wrong? Okay, this is what apologetics means. And so they were training high school students how to defend their faith, and then they would send us out two by two, because that's biblical, they would send us out two by two into the beaches of Huntington Beach, California to, yes, that's the correct response, to interrupt people who were just trying to have a family vacation and say, excuse me, ma'am, can I ask you a question? And inside you're probably like, dear God, no, who are you? But you're polite, so you're like, okay, sure. And then I respond with, if you were to die right now, do you know where you would go? Who starts a conversation like this? Baptist, that's the correct answer. And so I go out that first afternoon. Now, I should give you some context to say, yes, I'd been going to church my whole life. Yes, I'd been going to youth group. But I wasn't really, like, I didn't really, it wasn't really me. It was just a thing that I did. Going to youth group was just a thing that I did. I didn't really care about, it was just a thing that I did. And so that first morning, we get trained. We go out. I go out with my partner. I don't even remember who it was. And we engage a few people in conversation. Sadly, I didn't save any souls that afternoon. My great Billy Graham career was still yet ahead of me. And I come back to the dorm room that we were staying at that afternoon, the first afternoon. And I go through the door. It's okay if you need to take it, Sadie. We can wait. You're good? Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's okay. I know these two now because we had lunch, so I can now bust their chops, and it's fine. And I get into my room that first afternoon, and I fall face down on my bed, and I just start weeping. Which now in my life is kind of par for the course. I'm kind of an easy cry now. But back then, like, I don't know if I'd ever cried prior to that in my life. And I'm just weeping on the bed. And I'm not really sure why. I'm just sobbing. And a few moments go by, and I'm suddenly overwhelmed with this impression, this sense. I don't know how to describe it. Back at the time, I would have maybe used more direct language, like, in that moment, I felt or I heard God speak to me. Now, it wasn't an audible voice. It's not the point. But I became very, very aware of the fact that I had just spent a couple hours on the beach being a complete fraud. I was out there telling people how to have a relationship with God through Jesus when I myself had no idea what I was talking about. I mean, that wasn't true for me at all. And this sense of being a fraud, this sense of not being integrated, where my insides and my outsides were aligned, it broke me. And I remember in that moment feeling as though there were two paths in front of me. And again, back then I would have said God put two paths in front of me. Now I'm not entirely sure what the difference is between saying God put two paths in front of me and there just were two paths in front of me. It's like, I think we're saying the same thing here. But I felt like I had two paths to choose from. One was just keep going business as usual. Keep being a 17-year-old kid whose life revolved around himself, which is redundant to be a 17-year-old kid, right? His life was, and it's just all about me, and pretend to be this thing that I'm not. Or I could use this opportunity to make a serious change in my life and make my life about something more than just me and really throw myself into God, whatever that meant. And that was what I chose. In that moment, I'm like, all right, I'm ready to do this. I'm ready. I don't know if anybody can relate to this language, but back then I would have framed it as I was ready to be on fire for Jesus, you know, or give my life to the Lord. I mean, I'd already been saved because, again, I was a Baptist, so 5 years old I said the prayer, so I was good. Yeah, that moment I'm like, okay, I'm ready to throw myself into this. And for the next week, I took it seriously. I showed up. I was earnest and honest. And at the end of the week, I felt this over the last like session, I felt this calling from God. Again, that's the language I used back then. And even now, I'm like, I don't know, probably calling from God to give my life to ministry, to be a pastor. I'm like, okay, I guess that's what I'm going to do. So I abandoned my plans to travel back to the East Coast for graphic design, and I enrolled in a Christian liberal arts college, and I went and I got my degree in pastoral ministry from Western Baptist College. I know, impressive. And I graduate in 2004, and I get a job at a church in Salem, Oregon, part of the Christian Missionary Alliance denomination. I don't know if y'all have that out here, CMA, Christian Missionary Alliance, not Country Music Awards. And I'm working there for about a year, and I get ready to go through the licensing process to be a licensed pastor in the denomination, because my younger brother and his fiance were getting married and they wanted me to do the ceremony. So I'm going through the process of being licensed, which involves a couple of things, filling out some forms and some essays, and it culminates with a interview with a panel of, you know, elder statesmen in the denomination, whatever. And so I'm preparing for this interview, which I'm told usually it's like 30 to 40 minutes. Mine ended up going 4 hours because of what I'm about to tell you. And so I'm studying for this, and one of the things I have to do is I have to acclimate myself to the policies and the procedures of the denomination. Like, I gotta know what this denomination is about. So I can remember one afternoon on my lunch break, I'm walking through the lobby of this church and reading the policies and procedures manual of the denomination, and I get to a line in one of the pages that says something to the following. It says, practicing homosexuals cannot be members of the church. And I remember stopping and thinking to myself, but what if they're like really good at it? Followed by the thought of, some of you in the room didn't get it, practicing homosexuals. Okay, now you're caught up. I just felt the need to relieve that tension a little bit. My thought was, okay, again, at the time, you got to remember where I was at, solid Baptist, evangelical, like I had the theology correct. But in that moment, I noticed my heart suddenly broke a bit. Like, wait a minute. Yeah, I get it. Like, being gay is a sin and it's not God's design and all that. But wait, they can't be members of a church? And I kept reading, and it listed off all the areas in the churches that they couldn't serve, right? They could be greeters, parking lot attendees, right? But they couldn't serve with kids for sure, couldn't be on the platform, and all these. And I'm telling you this because that was the first moment where I noticed there was a lack of alignment between my head and my heart. These two things were not in alignment. My head was one place, rooted in this theological tradition that had been given me and that I had adopted. But my heart was now over here in this place of, is this the outflow of this theology? I don't know about that. Fast forward a year. I passed the licensing exam, but they did get hung up a little bit on that and some other matters. But ultimately, I'm like, hey, look, I will serve the denomination. I'm not here to, like, I get it. That's the position of the church. It's fine. But around that same time, I also started reading books that, let's just say they wouldn't have made the syllabus of my Baptist professors, you know, like not on the approved reading list. They were all Christians. They were just not in this. Because what you don't understand about Baptists is Baptists have this assumption that it goes Jesus, Peter, Paul, Baptist. Like in this unbroken, I don't know how they explain the 1800-year gap there. It doesn't matter. There's just this, like, this unbroken assumption that, like, we have the correct view on everything. And I didn't realize, and so I'm reading these books a couple of years after college, and I start to be opened to the realization that, there have been faithful saints all throughout our 2,000 years of history that have asked all similar questions and landed in all sorts of different places. Like, there has been caked in variety of perspectives from the beginning. I had no idea that these were, like, legitimate, earnest, God-fearing, Christ-following humans that were just landing in different places than my sort of narrow Baptist evangelical way. And so I began to do this process. Now I talk about it in terms of auditing my faith or auditing my religion. I talk of it like a Jenga tower, you know, Jenga, where you pull the blocks out and then you kind of put it back on top, and then one of your kids comes over and knocks it over, and you're like, I am not setting that thing back up again. That was a one-time game, and it's over now. But Jenga, so you pull out these beliefs. This process of taking a belief that you've held for so long, and you extract it, and you hold it up, and you get curious about it, and you ask questions of it. Like, where did this come from, first of all? What are some other ways to think about it? What do I want to think about it? And we get curious about these beliefs. And just like Jenga, sometimes you will hold on to this belief, but you'll turn it a little. Like, but it's going to be a bit different. I'll keep this belief still, but it's different now because I've gotten more curious about it. And other times we will maybe set the block on the table next to it. Like, I don't know. I'm not ready to maybe put this back on my tower, but nor am I ready to cast it away. I just don't know, so it's going to lie over here. And then sometimes we look at these beliefs and we're like, get away. Like, no, I'm done with that, right? So I'm going through this process of auditing all these beliefs, and I moved from Oregon to Arizona, don't recommend, but moved to Arizona, and I become, I'm on the staff there, the worship and arts pastor at this large mega church in outside of Phoenix. All the while, still kind of doing this auditing of my belief, but mostly keeping it to myself. If you've ever gone through this process, now we have language for, like, deconstruction. That we didn't really use that term 12 years ago, and I don't even know that it reflects my experience all that much, but now that might be how people talk about it. But if you've ever done a process like that, you know that sometimes you kind of got to keep things to yourself because the community, the family that you have might not receive those questions that you have all that well. And yet I'm also pastoring at the same time. And so I'm sort of in this world where I'm trying to find ways to grow and to change and to develop and to think through what I believe while also trying to be true and faithful and honest to our community. And more or less, I do a decent job, I think, for the first couple years. But then at some point, and I still to this day cannot remember why I finally decided to, But I finally decided in about 2009 or 10 to revisit that moment in 2005 when I was in the lobby of the church and I noticed this lack of alignment between my head and my heart. Because I just kind of let myself sit in that tension for years. But somewhere, some reason in 2009 or 10, I'm like, I need to revisit this. I need to actually figure out which piece of me needs to get in line with the other one. And I didn't know how it would go, by the way. I hadn't, up to that point, spent much or any time looking at what are called the clobber passages. These are the six verses in the Bible that historically have been misused to justify discrimination against those who identify LGBTQ. They've been used to clobber gay people for far too long. I'd never really looked at them. I'd just kind of taken the party line that, oh yeah, the Bible's clear, right? It's an abomination, or you can't be gay Christian, or you can't inherit the kingdom of God. All of these things I just adopted. But for reasons that still aren't entirely clear to me to this day, I knew that I needed to take an honest look at that. And it's not because I knew anyone who was gay. I didn't have any gay friends or family members. It's just because I wanted to be a man of integrity, damn it. Going all the way back to that story of being a 17-year-old weeping on a college dorm bed because I had been so broken by my lack of integrity of being someone on the inside and the out that didn't match. Yet again, I was confronted with this lack of integration in my life. And so I threw myself into the study of these verses. Spoiler alert. What I learned was that we've gotten it wrong. We've gotten it wrong. The church has gotten this wrong. And it's okay to say that, by the way. Because we've gotten things wrong before. We have. And we know this. For 1,500 years or so, the church just taught that the earth was the center of the universe. Because why? I don't know. There's a verse in the Bible that says that the earth is fixed and it doesn't move. And someone comes along, Galileo, and with math and long sticks of wood and glass, shows that, well, maybe the earth isn't, maybe we go around the sun. Okay, so we got that wrong. And the church quickly repented and moved on. No. slavery. Yeah, we got that wrong. For how many years did the church use the Bible to justify the idea that we can own another human being? Yeah, we got that wrong. Wrong. The idea that men are somehow superior to women in some way. We got that wrong. We can name it. Like, we have misunderstood, misused, misapplied, isolated portions of this holy book in such a way that has led to disastrous harm. We've done it before on different issues. We were wrong. Just because people said to me early on, like, Colby, this is how the church was taught for 2,000 years. Like, you're really just going to say that all those people were wrong? Yes, I am. Join me. Like, yes. And so I went into that not knowing if the head was going to have to get in line or the heart or what was going to happen, but it was... Thankfully now, the head followed the heart into this path of a theology of inclusion, of realizing that the Bible does not have anything to say to those who are gay or lesbian or transgender. It doesn't have any word of condemnation. But I kept it to myself. Because I had a wife at the time, I had 3.5 kids at the time, and I had a mortgage at the time. And I was the only one, I was the sole breadwinner. And I'm like, if I say anything about this, I'm pretty sure my job will be in jeopardy. And I took a little bit of comfort. I'll tell you a quick story. I took a little bit of, and this is, in some part, this is, I think, a bit of justification and rationalization. So there's a part of me that like, really? But there's another part of me that wants to be tender and kind to that part of my life, like kind to myself. And this is a big thing that I preach now, like be kind to past versions of yourself. Like you were doing the best you can with what you had. Life's hard. And so, but that there was about a year or so of when I had shifted my theology on this, but I kept it to myself. And I found comfort in this story that comes from 2 Kings chapter 5, where there's a guy by the name of Naaman. And Naaman serves his master in some foreign land, and he develops leprosy, and he hears about, it's either Elijah or Elisha, I don't know, for the sake of the story, same guy, some prophet in Israel. So he goes over to Elijah, and he seeks healing, and Elijah gives Naaman this recipe for like dipping in the Jordan River, and he gets healed of his leprosy. And Naaman has this great conversion experience where Naaman confesses, I now see that the real true God is your God, Yahweh. Which, by the way, in that world, everybody had their own gods. Every tribe had their own gods, including Yahweh. Yahweh originally was a polytheistic religion just like everybody else because everyone back then was. That's why you have commandments like, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Because the assumption was there's other gods, Yahweh's the most high God. Anyway, and so Naaman's like, yeah, I see that the true God, the best God is Yahweh. But then Naaman says to Elijah, but I'm nervous, this is my translation, I'm nervous for when I go back home and resume serving my master, and we go in and we have to do our worship to this foreign God, what do I do? And the question is like, how do I handle this fact that I've got this new conviction, but I got to go do my job. Like, and I'll be killed if I don't serve my master. And Elijah, I really should figure out which prophet it is because this is getting real confusing, says to Naaman, thank you, Elisha, says to, what a wonderful gift you just gave the whole room. Thank you, sir. Everybody can breathe easier now. Elisha says to Naaman, when you go back, make sure that you are completely open and honest with your master, even if it means your death. That's actually not what he said. He said, go in peace. Go in peace. He gives this permission slip, if you will, for Naaman to take his convictions back and just let them be in his own heart. And so for a year or so at my job in Arizona, I called it the Naaman effect, where I'm like, okay, yes, I have this new conviction, but I feel it's okay for me for now to sort of keep it in here. But here's the thing about the Naaman effect. I don't think it's meant to last forever. I think it's one of those temporary processes as we move towards fuller integration, because the soul is not designed to live disintegrated for that long. And so after about a year or so of living in this kind of, yes, I'd integrated my head and my heart, but now I had a new lack of alignment between my internal convictions and my external reality all over again. About a year after that, well, it was September of 2011. And President Obama signed the repeal for the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the ban against gay and lesbian service members. He repealed that. And I read about the article on the interwebs. I went to www.facebook.com and I shared this article with six words in my post. I'm glad this day finally came. Now, I submit to you that consciously I just thought that I was supporting the end of what I viewed to be a discriminatory practice. And consciously, I naively thought that my church would probably feel the same way. Because my church at the time was very at the forefront in a lot of social justice issues. Really, really hit home hard this message that in the kingdom of God, there's no room for discrimination. I just didn't read the fine print. And so there's a part of me, the conscious part, that thought, this is just celebrating the end of discrimination. I get to office the next morning, or I wake up the next morning, pardon, and I open Facebook and I just see this string, just this onslaught of comments from people in the church freaking out. Like, why is the church pro-homosexual now? Or why are the pastors advocating for the gay agenda? Which, by the way, I've been an ally for 12 years. Where's my copy of the gay agenda? I still don't have it yet. Anyway, this is my friend Derek, by the way. Derek and I go way back. He was him and his family were part of our church back in San Diego. And all these people in the church were just freaking out. And I get to the office, and my boss calls me in. He's like, "What have you done?" And he said, "Will you please take it down? It's causing so much chaos." And so I took it down because I didn't want to be a disruption. And I thought that was the end of it. But 3 days later, I was called in for an emergency board meeting on a Friday. And that's never a word you want to hear in front of board meeting. Actually, most of the time, like, board meeting itself is like, "Whoa." But emergency, never a good thing. So I'm brought into this board meeting with 8 other men, because we were a good evangelical church. 8 other men in the room, man, just shot everywhere. And was asked point blank, like, "What do you think about same-sex marriage? What do you think about gay people?" And so I came out of the theological closet in that room to these 8 men. I told them, I said, well, I didn't tell them, actually. I typed up a letter. It was like 10 pages long. Because if you haven't figured out by now, I'm a bit verbose. Don't laugh too hard, please. Thank you. my life motto is, why use 10 words when 50 will do, right? And so I wrote up this letter. But really, it was because I knew I'd be so nervous, I didn't want to go off the cuff. And I'd probably, if I just went extemporaneously, I might cave and do my sort of fawn response, right? Fight, flight, freeze, fawn. Fawn response is where you like assuage the other person that everything's going to be okay. I might have like actually just taken the cowardly way out. Be like, "No, sorry guys, total mistake. All good here." I didn't want to do that. I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't. I could not live like that anymore. So come what may, I read this letter and I briefly shared the outcome of my research and where I landed on this topic, and that yes, I'm in favor of same-sex marriage. And I don't think gay people are abominations. But can I keep my job? And so we had, they asked questions, maybe about an hour or so it lasted. They asked me to step outside while they deliberated. And I can remember sitting in the cry room. Do y'all know what cry rooms are? Yeah, right? The tinted one-way window so that, you know, we can get the disruptive children out of there. Because us evangelicals, everything's got to be perfect and excellent. And so I'm in the cry room with a couple other friends. I'm eating Chipotle, waiting for the verdict. And I get called back in, and they said, don't bother coming in on Sunday. We'll fill your spot while we sort this out. Take the weekend off." Which meant I didn't go to church that Sunday, which meant I never saw my church again. Because then 2 days after that, on Tuesday, when I came back into the office, I was handed my letter of termination effective immediately. Now, at the time, that was devastating. I'd worked there for 5 years. We had built a home there, both physically and metaphorically. My wife at the time was pregnant with our 4th kid, and we had to just sell it all and leave. At the time, it was devastating. Now, I tell you, that was like the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. How interesting is that, by the way? Some of you are like, "Not all that interesting," because that's my story too. How many of us is that true for? We look back on the timeline of our lives and we see that some of the hardest, most painful, most difficult, dark nights of the soul, the thing we wouldn't wish upon anybody. We look back on that. And now we look back with, is that gratitude in our hearts? Are we now thankful for that? There's a Tibetan monk by the name of Thich Nhat Hanh who passed away a couple years ago. And one of my favorite things that Thich Nhat Hanh teaches is he says, because he's a good Buddhist, but he also integrated, he had this great overlap of Buddhism and Christianity. And in Buddhism, one of the foundational truths is that life is dukkha. And dukkha is often translated as suffering, which isn't necessarily a great translation, but dukkha is this idea that life will always sort of be unsatisfactory. Like there will always be this point of a kind of suffering experience in life. And Thich Nhat Hanh taught that if you want to suffer less, if you want to have the experience of suffering to lessen, then you need to learn to suffer better. When you suffer better, you suffer less. And I thought a lot about that, and I think one of the ways that we can learn to suffer better, get better at suffering, if you will, improve our experience, is to close this gap between when the event happens that brings about the great suffering, sadness, pain, chaos, close the gap between that moment and when we can find a bit of gratitude for it. The more we close that, actually the less we end up suffering. How great is that? How great is that? And so, yeah, that was tragic in my life. And yet now I look back on it as like the greatest thing ever. Because when we left Arizona in 2011, we moved back to Oregon for a short stint to kind of recoup, hit the reset button. And then we moved down to San Diego in 2012. And joined another church. That didn't work out for various reasons. But out of that, we then created this church in our living room in 2014 called Sojourn Grace Collective, and Derek and your family were a part of, Sojourn Grace Collective. And we did that for the next almost nine years. And so when Danny was introducing me, and he pointed out, for the first 10 years, I've been a pastor in conservative evangelical spaces. In the last 10 years, I've now been in this kind of post-evangelical progressive space. And so shortly after starting this church in San Diego, I had been for the last couple years, since being fired from my church in Arizona, I'd been putting together in written form the research that I'd done on the clobber passages. They started out as Facebook. What's with me in Facebook? Get off Facebook. They started with just trying to answer people on Facebook, like, why did you get fired? Don't you know about Sodom and Gomorrah? Or haven't you read 1 Corinthians 6:9? It's like, wow, thanks for telling me. I never knew that verse existed. This changes everything. That was my sarcasm font. So it started out just trying to respond to people one-off, and that's not an effective way to communicate at all, let alone in this conversation. So then it moved to blog posts. I don't know if you remember blog posts. It was this thing that the internet did years ago. And then it shifted to this teaching forum, this class that I would do. And then in 2015, I was given a talk at some conference, I was approached by an editor at a publishing company afterwards, and she said, if you ever want to turn that into a book, let's talk. And I said, I definitely want to do that. So that the book, one of the books back there is called Unclobber, Rethinking Our Misuse of the Bible and Homosexuality. And half of the book, you kind of already got tonight, it's my story of sort of moving through this topic and changing my heart and mind on it and getting fired and starting a church in San Diego. And then the other half of the book is my research into the clobber passages to show we've gotten this topic wrong. And that came out in 2016. And then we're doing our church in Arizona, or I'm sorry, in San Diego. And I noticed that for these 10 years or so that I've been doing this work with people who have left conservative Christianity or been kicked out of it, and they are on their way towards something, but they want it to still be Christian. Like there's still something compelling them to stay anchored to the tradition of Christianity, but they know in their hearts, they know in their gut that it's got to be more open, more progressive, more inclusive. And so many of the people that I had pastored and shepherded and counseled through this process, I noticed some of the same things coming up over and over and over again. So my second book is called The Shift, Surviving and Thriving After Moving from Conservative to Progressive Christianity. And it's a survival guide for this journey. It's, hey, here's some of the obstacles that you probably already have faced or are going to face. Things such as, what do I do when old versions of myself kind of creep up out of nowhere and resent the fact that I've now changed my mind on this? You ever had that experience where like some previous version pops up in your mind and they're like, what are you doing? You're throwing all of this away? We worked really hard. We went to so many Bible studies, so many prayer groups, and now you're just walking out on me? I don't think so. You're getting your three wishes, so sit down. Anybody? Aladdin? No? Thank you. One person's with me. If I would have done it in the genie voice, maybe they would have gotten it or not. Other questions like, what do I do with God? How do I think about God? Questions like, what do I do about Jesus now? Because I kind of feel like still important, but now I have a different way to think about it. What about the Bible? This thing that has all these complications to it. And so that's the shift. And I think there's only one or two copies left, by the way. But if you want to take a copy home, and I have sold out, just talk to me. You can still buy it, and I'll sign it, and I'll ship it to you. I just need your address. And so that came out in 2020, just right when the pandemic hit. So it kind of, put a kibosh on the whole launch. The whole tour got canceled. Because I don't know if you know this, but when the pandemic hit in 2020, people weren't interested in like spiritual enlightenment books. Like my publisher told me, for those first 2 months after the pandemic hit, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, everybody was just buying books like how do I grow potatoes in my backyard, right? Like that's what people were buying. They weren't buying like how do I be a progressive Christian? Like that nobody was. So anyway, moving on. And so now the work that I do. So we closed our church back in 2022, speaking of the pandemic. We ultimately didn't survive. Like we did a virtual church for 2 years. It was great. Then we tried to come back in person, and the church just wasn't there anymore. And it would have felt like starting over. And after doing ministry for 20 years, I just didn't have it in me to start over. So we let it end, which, by the way, is fine. Somehow in America, we live with this assumption that if a thing ends, that it's a failure. Newsflash, everything ends. Everything ends. And not everything's a failure. Like, what does that even mean? So it was a beautiful, brilliant 8-9 years of my life. Like, the greatest achievements of my life were in that. The lives that were changed and touched. And so we put that to bed in 2022. And since that time, I've transitioned to, I call it a digital pastor. I don't know, it kind of works, but basically it's just my way of saying I still do this work, but I do it online, I do it virtually. I see spiritual coaching clients over Zoom. I travel and I speak, and I'm writing prolifically online. I come and I meet people like you with a message like this. So that's a bit about me. Now a quick bit about God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We're starting all over again. And it was dark. It was dark. And God spoke and said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God called it good. Have you ever stopped to ask the question, why? What's so good about the light? What's so good about the light? It can't just be that light is good and dark is bad. No. We've seen the outflow of where that kind of dichotomous thinking gets us, that lightness is good and darkness is bad. Get behind me, Satan, with that thinking, for reals. It can't just be that light is good and dark is bad. You know you're just as blind in pure light as you are in pure darkness. Like, so it can't be that. So why would light be considered good in this context? Well, what if the reason why light is good is because when you mix light with dark, suddenly you have contrast, you have differentiation. You can see what otherwise could not have been seen before in pure light or pure dark. A couple chapters after that in the book of Genesis, chapter 11, there's this story about all of the peoples of the land had one nation, one tongue, one culture. And they thought to themselves, let's build for ourselves a city with a giant tower. Let's make a name for ourselves. And they set about this project with this new technology they had where they could put mortar and bricks together and build buildings that have never been built before. You know the story, right? God sees this. God's like, this is my translation. God's like, oh, crap. This isn't going to go well for them. And he scatters people all across the world. Why? Why is that? Well, maybe because God knows that this human proclivity towards sameness, this inclination, this genetic disposition, you can even say, because at a fundamental DNA level, we are coded and hardwired to be drawn towards that which is similar to us and to be afraid of that which is different. This is baked into us. And it's almost as though God saw this thing happening within humanity where everybody had one nation, one tongue. There was nothing but conformity and sameness. And I think God got a little freaked out that that was the path that humanity was on. And so God introduced this multitude of languages and cultures. That's interesting. One more story, now all the way in Acts chapter 2. Jesus had died, come back from the dead, ate some fish, and then ascended. And his friends were left wondering, well, now what do we do? Our leader's gone. Well, it's Sabbath, we might as well all get together and do the thing that we normally do. And so they did, and it was Pentecost, was the holy day. And they get together, and they're breaking bread, and they're having a meal, and they're singing songs, and they're doing prayers. And then suddenly, man, the description of this is wild. Suddenly they're like, I don't know, how do we describe it? There was like these flaming tongues that were everywhere. Like, you can imagine the first guy that wrote that down, the guy next to him was like, really? That's what you're going with? Flaming tongues? I don't know what else to say. It's the best we got. Flaming tongues. They're going to think this was really weird 2,000 years from now. I know. That's kind of fun, isn't it? And in this house, in this gathering, suddenly people started hearing different languages being uttered. And if you read this story, it's incredible. The people outside began to gather around and they're like, wait a minute, everybody inside, we know all of them. They're all Galileans. They all speak the same language. They're all the same. And yet I hear them in my language. 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 I read this story and here's the impression that I get. It's as though the Spirit of God, she saw this new thing that was happening, this movement, this emergence that was about to take off, inspired by the life and the teachings and the death and the resurrection and all of the movement of Jesus. This new thing was emerging in the world. And it's almost as though the Spirit of God, she said, okay, this is not going to be the one more example of everybody thinking they have to look the same, be the same, talk the same, think the same. Not on my watch. And suddenly it's all mixed up again. And everybody hears it in their own language. And it's like from the get-go, this movement was not meant to be a movement of uniformity and conformity and sameness. And it wasn't meant to be back in the Tower of Babel. Confuse, mix it up. And it wasn't meant to be in the very beginning, because you need light, you need dark, you need the contrast, you need the differentiation. So what do I have to say tonight about God to you? I have this. There is a divine preference for diversity. There is a divine preference for diversity. Not sameness. Lord, forgive us for thinking that people need to look the same, talk the same, think the same, be the same. God's been trying since the very beginning to show the beauty of diversity and differentiation and contrast. Oh, so good. And yet, how often do we curve it back into sameness? One more thought about God, and then I'll get to you. I would hesitate us to always hear the parables of Jesus and associate God with the king or the master or the father. Like we have a tendency to do that. We have a tendency to read Jesus' parables and just assume that that character is representative of God. I don't think that's always the case. Where I do think, though, it was intended by Jesus to be a one-for-one swap is in the story of what we often call the prodigal son. I don't know if that's the best title for it, but, you know, the teen study Bibles have already been printed. The headers are out there, so. And I'm sure you know this story. Quick recap. Father has two sons, and the younger son one day comes to his dad and says, "I'd like my share of the inheritance, please," which was code for, "I kind of wish you were dead so that I could have what's mine. If I can have it now, that'd be great." And the father, by all accounts, didn't put up a fight. Like, "Here you go. Like, bless you." And the son goes and goes to faraway country and squanders it all and gets to a point where he's got nothing left. It's all gone. And he realizes that he's eating slop. He's picking up food wherever he can. And he thinks, "Man, even the servants at my dad's house have it better than this. I'm gonna go back and I'll see if my dad will take me back." And you know, you remember this, right? Like he's walking back to his dad's place, and he's got this speech all rehearsed, and he's ready to try to make amends and to repent and to confess and to do all the things that I'm sure his religious training had taught him, and it was deep inside him at some point. And you remember that's the part of the story, right, where the father sees the son from off in the distance, and what does he do? He runs, right? He runs to him, and he wraps himself around his son. And his son, you know, tries to go into his speech. I'm like, "Oh, Father, I've wronged you." And he starts to, "Wah, wah, wah." And the dad is just like, "You're home. This is incredible," right? And puts a ring on his finger and a robe. And he's like, "Come, we're going to have a party. My son who has been lost his home." Like, it's all dad cared about. It's all dad cared about. And so they go and they have a big party. And you know the story. Everyone shows up to the party except for who? The older brother. And the older brother in this story is frustrated, upset, angry at his brother, probably at his dad, certainly at himself, probably if he's honest. And the dad comes and finds him and is like, "Hey, your brother's home and we're having a big party. Where are you?" And the older son goes into he just spews his feelings. He's like, "Dad, you've never even given me so much as a goat for me and my friends to have a barbecue with. Right? I've done everything right." And then this brother of mine he goes off and makes a mess of things and comes back and gets a whole cow. Like, what is And the dad in that moment, and again, I think that in Jesus' telling of this story, he was doing his best to convey his understanding of the divine, which for Jesus was a very fatherly presence, our Father who art in heaven. This is how Jesus experienced God. I'd like to think that there's some part of the Father in this story whose heart breaks a little. In part for his son, but maybe a little in part for himself. I don't know, can God's heart break for God's self? Why am I saying that? Because maybe there's a point in which this father realized, maybe I failed my children. Because here's what the father says to the older son. He says, "Bud, everything I have has always been yours. But I don't hear it in like a luxury way. Like, you idiot, you could have had a goat whenever you want. Everything I have has always been yours." No, I hear it in this like tender, like, oh, somehow you missed that, didn't you? Somehow you missed that. That everything I have has always been yours. Here's what I think is true about God, and it pivots into the last thing I'll say about you. When it comes to God, and we could say God's love, although that's a bit redundant, because God is love, so God's love becomes just the way to say the same thing. When it comes to love, these two sons both erred in opposite directions. The younger son thought he didn't deserve dad's love. The older son thought he did deserve dad's love. I did everything right. And dad's standing here saying, "Buds, come here. Deserving has nothing to do with it." When it comes to love, deserving has nothing to do with it. When it comes to love, deserving has nothing to do with it. You are loved by God in part because God is love. Ergo, there is no other option. That's what I believe. You're also loved by God because you are a child of God. And you can't ever mess that up. You can't. Nor can you ever do anything to earn it or deserve it. It doesn't work that way. Stops being love. Just as you are right now, just as you were a year ago, just as you were 5 years ago, you were loved by God. And I'll close with this, a word about you. There's a good chance that many in this room were not told that message for a really long time. For a lot of us in this room, we got some version of these two ideas about God, about love. That you are undeserving. There's something wrong with you. You are broken. You might say, "Colby, yeah, we're all broken." Okay. We can talk about that maybe later, sure. But some of us in this room, some of you in this room, I'm not going to put myself in that category, some of you in this room got that message on a hell of a deeper level than others did. And it was wrong. You didn't deserve that. I'm sorry. And then others in this room, you got this message that you had to hustle. You had to get it right. You had to do the right things, say the right things, believe the right things, not do the bad things. And you got this idea that, I don't know, somehow you could be good enough to find favor with God. And I want to say, I'm sorry, you didn't deserve to hear that message either. That you had, here's the thing that's true about you. You have never been, and you never will be, separated from God. It's not possible. And if the author of the book of 1 John is correct, and I tend to think he is, that God is love, and that means you have never been and never will be separated from love. It's just not possible. We all come from the same stuff, y'all. The same divine stardust. We're all made of it. Maybe you've heard the phrase Imago Dei, the image of God. It's a beautiful concept. It's not my favorite, only because it creates a bit of a separation, like image of, like a reflection of, which is cool and all. It's so much better than that. You actually have the divine in you now. You always have. And you always will. You can't screw that up. You can't lose it. You sure can't earn it. But what you can do, as Paul Tillich says, is you can accept that you are accepted. You can accept that you are accepted. You can accept that you are accepted. I'll end with this. One of the things that I do often, I have this mantra, and I'm going to share it with you. Because I think on one hand it's really powerful to have someone else, in this case me, be the proxy for God, to just sort of stand here and say, you are loved, like just as you are loved by the God. You have never been separated from God, you never can be, you are absolutely loved, that you, just as you are so good, and God loves you. Like, it's really powerful to have someone else say, you, sir, are so loved by God, just as you are. That's powerful. You know what else is powerful? When you can do it for yourself. So this is how I do it for myself. I place my hand on my heart. That's kind of where I feel my life force, right above my diaphragm sometimes with my breath, but just kind of here, I feel the beating of the heart. I'm going to invite you to do this. If we all do it, then none of us feel weird. I place it here. And I say these three lines. It's real simple. That's the point of a mantra. I say, I'm okay. Of course I'm okay. Because I've always been okay. And isn't that what we always want? We just want to be okay. We just want to be okay. Life's hard. We just want to feel okay. The good news is you are okay. Because of course you are. Because you've always been. So say it with me. Go ahead. Put your hand back on your heart. Some of you took it away. Knock it off. Say, I'm okay. Of course I'm okay. Because I've always been okay. Thank you for being here tonight. I love you. I really do. Thank you.